Welcome to Managing AML. I'm Dr. Alexander Pearl. Today I will review the evolving standard of care in AML, specifically FLT3 inhibitors. In this presentation, I'll summarize the diagnosis and prognosis of FLT3 mutated AML, the role of FLT3 inhibitors in the treatment of patients with this mutation, outline the efficacy and safety amongst current and emerging FLT3 inhibitors for the treatment of AML, and incorporate individual patient and treatment-related factors into decision-making processes for patients with AML. These are my disclosures. The first thing to know about FLT3 mutations in AML is that they're quite common. Indeed, FLT3 is the most commonly mutated gene in AML. We see this from a very large-scale genomic study done in Germany by Ellie Papemanuel of Memorial Sloan Kettering, where she looked across the genome at every mutation mutated in AML and looked to sequence all of these genes in a large data set of over 1,500 patients. And over 500 of these, or about a third of the patients, had mutations in FLT3. We know that FLT3 mutations occur largely in two flavors. One are internal tandem duplication mutations, shown in the cartoon diagram on the right, which occur in about perhaps 20 or 21% of patients with AML who are newly diagnosed. And an additional probably 10% of patients will have an activation loop mutation in the tyrosine kinase domain, often at the residue DA35. These two different mutations have a common clinical phenotype, which is that these patients often, though not always, present with very high white blood cell count, and their bone marrows often have a high blast percentage. The two different mutations have differing prognostic effects, which I'll show you in a minute, where FLT3 ITD mutations are generally considered more sinister and have particularly high relapse rates. And if we look at the karyotypes of patients with FLT3 mutations, they usually fall into the intermediate risk group. They often will have a normal karyotype, and they're commonly seen in patients who have either NPM1 mutations, DNMT3A mutations, or both mutations. Now, in terms of clinical effects, what FLT3 mutations do is they increase the relapse rate. In particular, the FLT3 ITD mutations increase relapse rates. The complete remission rates to induction chemotherapy for patients with FLT3 mutations are actually quite good and are largely not affected by the presence of the mutation if you look at patients by their karyotype. But unfortunately, if these relapses occur, they tend to occur early in the course of therapy. So patients may go into remission for only a few weeks or a few months, fall out of remission, and because of the short first remission duration, often don't respond well to salvage chemotherapy at that point. And that leads to very poor survival for patients with FLT3 ITD mutations. For this reason, because we know functionally FLT3 is a receptor tyrosine kinase, it activates downstream signaling that promotes the growth of leukemic cells, impairs their differentiation, and contributes to their survival, even in the context of chemotherapy. An inhibitor of FLT3 kinase might be very desirable, and drugs that targeted FLT3 have been in development for approximately 15 years. Recently, drugs that inhibited FLT3 as multi-kinase inhibitors were approved. Importantly, the drug midostaurin was approved last year for the therapy of patients with FLT3 mutations in combination with intensive daunorubicin and Ara-C-based chemotherapy. And more selective and more potent FLT3 inhibitors have been developed since that time to really maximize the effects of inhibiting FLT3. How do we diagnose FLT3 mutations? Well, there really are several different approaches, but most commonly we use PCR, polymerase chain reaction, or next generation sequencing, or NGS. These two tests are commonly done at diagnosis, but really you do want to do both studies, not one or the other. There's reasons for this. The PCR is advantageous because we get the fastest result, and it may be actually more sensitive at picking up FLT3 ITD mutations, which can be missed by some next generation sequencing panels. The PCR is also faster at getting us a result, and we know from the study that showed that midostaurin's addition to induction chemotherapy improves survival that you want to get an answer pretty quickly. On that study, patients were treated with midostaurin on day 8 of therapy and were given 14 days of treatment. So the one problem with the next generation sequencing is that the results may not come out for 3 weeks, and thus the window to treat the patient during induction may be lost. And again, that there's a survival benefit to adding midostaurin early in therapy, you don't want to miss that window. So I recommend sending PCR even if you're sending next generation sequencing. It's helpful later on to know that a FLT3 mutation is there on the odd chance that a low-level FLT3 ITD might be missed by PCR and picked up by next-gen sequencing. We sometimes do see that. And one advantage of next-gen sequencing panels is we can see the whole complement of different mutations in the leukemia, not just FLT3 itself. And that can give us important prognostic information and might help inform other therapies that we might want to add at some point, such as IDH mutations, or give us useful information that might help us make a transplant versus consolidation chemotherapy for post-remission therapy. This test can be very helpful in that regard. Now, importantly, both of these tests require myeloblasts. Next generation sequencing can pick up mutations in cells that are either immature or mature, but one problem with it and PCR is the FLT3 mutations may show up only in the blasts, and maybe even only in a subset of the blast, because FLT3 we think of as being a late mutation in the process of leukemogenesis. So we see patients who have FLT3 mutations in perhaps only 10% of their blasts, and if there's a wild type and a mutant type, you might be down at the very lowest levels of sensitivity in a patient who had 20% blasts in the bone marrow. So for this reason, a negative result on a FLT3 testing, if it didn't actually have at least 10% blasts in the sample, can't really be trusted. So we want to make sure that the samples that are tested have enough blasts to detect a mutation if it's really there. Now, over the years, we've seen, as I mentioned, that patients who had FLT3 mutations had worse survival than patients without these mutations, and it was particularly true for FLT3 ITD mutations, which are the bottom curve as shown on the left from a study done in Germany in 2002. In that study, patients received 7 and 3, cytarabine and anthracycline for up to 2 cycles, and then 3 to 4 cycles of high-dose Ara-C. While that's a standard treatment recommendation for patients before the development of FLT3 inhibitors, we know that these days we see better outcomes. And on the right is a more modern study where patients were given a more modern treatment approach, and this included the FLT3 inhibitor crenolinib. And as you can see, instead of being a very low curve there for FLT3 mutations, it's really at the top of the survival curve. And so we know with proper therapy, patients with FLT3 mutations can do very well. But it's important to recognize that you need to diagnose these patients and you need to treat them with these newer drugs to see these kinds of outcomes. And so 7 and 3 followed by high-dose Ara-C really isn't good enough therapy anymore for this subset. One major advance in the treatment of patients with FLT3 mutations, in particular for FLT3 ITD mutations, is the incorporation of allogeneic transplant in first remission. This was recognized in the mid-2000s, and this study from the AMLSG from Germany, published in the New England Journal by Richard Schlenk, shows that patients with certain genotypes and normal karyotype had really much better outcomes than others. In this study, they were trying to highlight the outcomes that were improved in patients who had nucleophosmin mutation or CEBP-alpha mutation in the absence of FLT3 ITD. If you look at all the other genotypes of normal karyotype AML, they have considerably worse outcomes. And if you look at those patients who had a donor versus those without a donor, on this study that allocated 80% of patients to transplant, you can see those with a donor did better. And from this, we infer that FLT3 ITD benefits in terms of survival from allogeneic transplant in first remission because it falls into that black curve at the bottom that's labeled other genotypes. We also know from more recent data that the combination of nucleophosmin mutation and FLT3 ITD softens the benefit of an NPM1 mutation significantly. And there's an interaction with DNMT3A R882 mutations. And we see all three mutations, which again are all quite common in AML, here from, again, the study from Elipap Emanuel. These are the three most common mutations, and they are often co-mutated in one combination or another. And all the permutations are shown here, with the NPM1 mutations on the top row, the DNMT3A mutations on the right column, and every permutation with or without a FLT3 mutation shown within the figures. FLT3 ITD here is the bottom curve on all four figures. But the biggest difference here is where we see all three mutations together. That's the top right, where FLT3 ITD, NPM1, and DNMT3A triple mutation has a very poor outcome, as is also true for any combination of DNMT3A and FLT3 ITD. So we know that we get additional information from next-generation sequencing that's better than just testing for an NPM1 mutation or FLT3 ITD, which would have been the standard up until recently. So there really is value in adding in next-gen sequencing at diagnosis to help risk stratify patients.